Good morning and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make the Elm City tick. Nothing ticks better than Pundit Friday, which is about to begin here in the WNHH studio. Number one edition of our third calendar year in business and number one pundits in the media universe right here in the WNHH studio. Pundits like Babs Rawls Ivy, the very vegan goddess and refrigerator wrestler of our grassroots radio operation, the bell of our ball, the managing editor of the Inner City News and host of WNHH's Love Babs program. You did just hear an encore performance of the program because Babs was wrestling with it.
Lord, I hope I don't have to get a
appliance
new refrigerator.
At her home. Just, I hope so too.
I hope praying, it's an
Babs,
electrical
praying
issue.
For you. I hope so too.
Please, because I have no money.
And returning after a few weeks off, we missed her so much. New Haven Independent Star reporter Markeisha Ricks.
And
hey,
I missed
happy
her
Friday,
a lot.
Everyone.
We did
I
miss
missed
her.
You all as well.
While you were gone, we got a new member permanent on the team.
Yes.
Norma Rodriguez Reyes, publisher of La Voz Hispana, who tried to usurp
Welcome,
you,
Norma.
But he said no, we got room for everybody. Morning, Norma. Okay, you might want to say that in the mic.
Good morning, everybody.
And I think there's somebody else in the room too, right?
Oh boy, let me fasten my seatbelt.
Because Markeisha gave
heard
you
a in
challenge.
A while. I gave you a challenge before I left.
Let's
so
see
let's
if we can
it.
Meet those challenge with two
oh,
out of the first
the challenge.
Team. Well, anyway, the fourth person in the studio today, the other pundit we have is that zealous zapper of xenophobia, the sagacious Sergeant Sultan of Swing, quintessential quipper of quotable quackery. The grandee of grandiloquence and gastronomics, our prize protector against pusillanimity, the distinguished duke of diplomacy and detente, the king of conspiracy concoction, deacon of the dozens, bodhisattva of battle rap, missionary of modesty, mesmerizer of the masses, shaman of the shoreline, potentate of 360 state, the recognized ringleader of risque repartee, the eighth wonder of the world, wizard of wise guy waggery, the capo of casual conversation, first name in flame, the daring don of dope deliberation, the sultan of spit, West Indian Whisperer of Wonk. He's the emperor of explosive exposition, the esteemed elucidator of ebonics, top tier talent from Trinidad and Tobago, the dap tone deliverer of decency, maximal media maestro, bodacious bold faced barista of bop, chess master of chill, primo practitioner of pop prestidigitation, the beyond just somewhat honorable high priest of hip hop, right reverend of rapture, reigning raconteur of riffitude, sanctified slayer of the slow witted, never late for supper. Decorated, dazzling, and indefatigable dunker and dryer of the dinner dishes, maximum mythologist Joe Ugly of the Joe Ugly Show in the Morning.
Oh
Joe, welcome.
God, I don't know who needs more therapy here.
The beard is coming in, folks. Joe Ugly is looking dapper. For
it 20. Is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hot.
Good.
It really is hot.
It is hot. It is
I was
hot.
Told that just yesterday, it looks exotic. I was like, whoa, let's roll with that
No,
one.
I think it looks smart.
I love it. It really is hot.
It's very
to me.
Distinguished. It's
you know, they say there are two sides to every question, but I think there's only one side to this question. That beard is a good move.
It is.
Thumbs up for the beard.
Seriously.
Beard gang.
Wow. Joe,
beard
you
gang.
Got all thumbs up, but don't get too comfortable because we got a rock and roll
it.
Here.
Forget what we think. I hope your wife likes it.
Well, I hope
she loves it.
It's hot. I'm telling
it looks
you.
Good.
But I hope people like the new look on Dixville Avenue, temporary look. Markeisha Ricks was documenting it today into New Haven Independence. She was there yesterday when the last outside walls of the Dixwell Q House, home for generations of community and place for kids to go, adults to hang out, you get help, you hang out, you learn stuff, you get food, you play pool or sports. The Q House is now down. It is history.
Is it?
It came down this week.
I've got to go drive by.
And check out the pictures in the Independent that are coming down from Markeisha. The new one is coming. Right, Markeisha, how much is it going to cost to build a new Q House?
The new Q House, I think, is coming in at about $15 million.
$15 million from the state.
From
and
the
it's
going
to include a new home, bigger for the Stetson Library, which really, because the Q House has been closed since 2003.
And the Stetson Library has kind of taken the place of the Q House.
That's where
that
people hang
space.
Out. Like after Joanna Cole, the girl who got shot dead, and her kids were already, their friends were already hanging out there and cousins and friends. And that is a place where they all gathered. You have all the kind of community events that take place there, all the homework
and they've got,
help.
They've got a dynamic librarian.
Diane Brown is amazing.
Sister Diane Brown.
And it's interesting
everything.
You say that because, you know, we do need physical spaces in our community. And the Q House became a symbol for people, not just in Dixwell, but in the Hill, Norma, with Trowbridge Square, with Hill Cooperative Youth Services.
That. Trowbridge Square didn't exist for, I mean... We haven't had anything like this in the Hill.
And
section.
All over
and
town.
And we don't have anything
and the
like
Board
this.
Well, Abby Booth used to be in the Hill.
Yeah, but that That's was right. many years ago.
And
I remember that.
We still have the Farnham Neighborhood House. But in general, there was a feeling that we've lost these community centers. Q House became the symbol, not just of the black community's aspirations for more support from government and communal spaces, but for the whole city, there's a Board of Aldermen Youth Committee that, or excuse me, Board of Alders that has a plan for bringing youth centers. This is the first biggie. The state came through with the money. But, you know, you said Diane Brown, because in the last years of the Q House, it wasn't doing great. And you talk about what she's done in such a small space as the librarian in Stetson. Everything happens there.
Oh, everything.
The Christmas kids with the hip-hop Christmas record that came
kids
in.
Kids do homework there every day.
When she calls me to run something in the inner city, I just say yes.
Or when the transportation department came, wanted to find out what the public thought about bus routes that came there. When people looking for jobs, they learn to use the computers there. When she gets the kids who used to hang out there, when they're college kids, they come back and they mentor and give the homework help with the younger kids. I think that's a reminder, because that's a small space, not the big Q House, that yes, we need the public spaces, but it's also the people who make it happen and they find the space.
I remember the Q House as a kid. I used to hang out at National Street Projects, and that was the home for the Q House, you know, in the evening. I learned how to play nine ball pool.
What is nine ball pool?
It's a hustle.
It doesn't have to be, though.
I took dance lessons over at Q House.
And Jeanette Marston took gymnastics there.
Yeah.
Georgie Perez apparently learned how to play guitar there.
Yeah, we never knew George Perez, the bank commissioner, former Board of Alders president, plays guitar. I'd like to hear what kind of music he plays. Because he's usually known as this kind of little bit stiff guy, just to be a little
honest. I don't know, he might play a little Cuban guitar. Come on. Yeah.
You know, speaking of pool over there, that was the very first place that the cue ball was not allowed to hit the eight ball. That was the very first place that I ever saw that.
What do you mean?
Well, you use the eight ball opposed to the cue ball because it was a belief
the
white the ball
is white.
Be hitting the black
white
ball.
That is so interesting.
That is something, that
okay,
was something
so who here knows what the cue for the cue house stands for?
It does not.
It doesn't stand for anything.
No. Are you sure of that?
No, because this is my burning question.
It's the community house, and it was just a slang. Right? From what I understood.
Cue for like community?
Yeah.
No, it was just a slang.
Doesn't mean quintessential quipper or quotable quack. So here's my other question. So there are other spaces in Dixwell. For instance, you have that whole community center built where Yale just built its police station. And
it's used.
It's used.
People use it.
But there's something about the cue that the community felt an ownership of. That I'm wondering why it's different. Why instead of, and also the Moxler Grant School, right next to the Q House, has a, you know, we thought of these as community schools and rebuilt them. We built them bigger. We had spaces to have after school sports and other activities. They do take place there. Why was it so important? And it was, and we respect that, and then the community came behind it, the governor supported it. Why was it so important for a $15 million new home? Right next door where we built a much more expensive school that had the space right down the block where they built a new community center at Yale. I mean, we can't have enough centers, but as we know, we also need the people to run them. Why is that? Why? What was it about the hallowed ground of the Q?
I mean, I think it has, I mean, it's generational, and the history is so rooted. You know, everything jumped off there. The Black Power Movement. I mean, all kinds of stuff.
We think about
just
the John Daniels growing up there and then his mayoral campaign starting there in the meeting rooms. Yeah.
But just everyday ordinary folks were there, right? Like, you know,
I think it's a historic spot for the Black community from Dixwell. Like, it's a
no question.
That spot is historic.
A positive spot.
Exactly.
There's nothing negative about that. That people feel like that important so things true. Happened to them and everyone they knew at that spot. So you know what that makes me wonder, folks, is whether sometimes places do matter because of the associations people have with them. Because if you stuck back, if you were someone who didn't come from New Haven, you were a bean counter, right? Or a policy analyst. You would say, let's not spend $15 million on building a new building. You got the Stetson Library. You got the Wexler Grant next door. You got the Yale Community Center down the street. And yet, obviously, it was important. And I have no doubt that the many people in the community have been a part of bringing this back.
Right.
You know, it's come from the grassroots. I have no doubt a lot of good things are going to happen there that wouldn't have happened in those other spaces.
Right.
And it makes me wonder whether there's something almost undefinable about locations, about hallowed ground, how it comes to have a meaning of its own.
I think,
or maybe that's ridiculous.
To the Q House, Paul, what I think comes from that, and I grew up in that community, and I think what you hear is a parent telling their kid about their experience at the Q House and what that was about. And that's being passed on. It's very much so generational. The Q House really meant something. I was not from the Dixwell community, but I literally feel as if
I was. Or you're from
was,
New Hallville, which isn't that far.
Exactly. But
I mean, you could have walked there.
I did.
Yeah.
But I still, although I had to go up Mansfield, but that's another story. But anyway,
Joe, that's like four blocks.
I had to go up Mansfield, no, up to Mansfield, opposed to just being able to walk across Winchester.
Oh,
Avenue.
Because they closed the gates
Thank
in
you.
Those
That's
years, but now
story.
They're open now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, I forgot about that. Oh,
that yeah. is kind of a long, winding road on the hill.
Oh, now we're getting
there,
to yeah. a long, winding road.
Especially for a kid.
It's like
dark,
now it's not
yeah.
just four blocks.
Exactly.
But wait, why couldn't you walk all the way down the hill?
To Shelton?
Yeah.
Then you had to go all the way across Shelton to Dixwell, opposed to if you go up Division, across Mansfield, down what we used to call Chocolate Hill, which was Henry Street.
Hill.
Yeah, and then you're right there at...
Okay, so folks, I do think there's going to be a challenge. So in the Q House's final years, there were several, the old independent newspaper and the Advocate we covered, efforts to try to keep the Q House going. The community said it's not being run well, the money wasn't spent well, the community didn't have enough people to rally. I remember Gimme Five for the Q House when Frank Williams tried to save it. He was a community leader. And he donated his time to sort of get that place going. And there wasn't enough to keep it going. So when we have the new home, how do we ensure that there's enough community involvement and community support to keep it going? Any thoughts on that?
Would you feel like all the things that are going, like the new Q House is going to be very different from the old Q House in that there are going to be so many things there? Yes, the library is going to be there, but also there's going to be a health center there for Cornell Scott. There's going to be a senior center there. There's going to be a full-size gymnasium, so there will always be an opportunity.
So I think you just answered it, Markeisha. The fact that the Stetson is a viable ongoing operation, and hopefully, you know, Diane Brown lives forever, but, you know, there are other people come. But I think you're right. I think that might be what's different. When you walked in this Q House those last years, most of the time there was nothing going on in there. Now with this corner, I guess you're right there. You
There's
think about
always
it.
Be
when you're talking about Carl Scott Health Center, the people coming in and out, and there'll be that own organization's budget paying in the lights and the oil and having people in there and eyes on there. And people coming in for the health center might come in for other reasons.
And the way Bill McMullen put it to me yesterday was he mentioned that the idea of putting Stetson in the Q House was like having a prime store in a mall, which is that you always have a draw there. Like putting Macy's in the mall makes the difference.
That makes
about
so much
there.
Sense. You bring people in so that if you try, you have another event coming
it's an anchor
up,
store.
Whether you're giving out the turkeys or you're having a sports league, you're having parents and kids get involved in something, they've already been there for the health center or for their library.
So what's going to happen to the space across the street?
That's
I'm not
question.
Sure because that's part of the, and that's another from that same era of the 60s when the Q House went up, so did Dixwell Plaza. And that's another example of how that was owned cooperatively by black-owned businesses. We saw a decline of black-owned business on the avenue. And that now the people there under the auspices of Ray Harp and the Greater New Haven Business Professional Organization are trying to get that place rebuilt and strengthened. And
I wish I had some money because I would put I'd put a black theater over
be
there.
Nice to have I've Inner City News that. Over there.
Inner City News could be over there. I'd have
Why
a,
not?
I'd have a Dixwell
you know,
Tea
you
House
could have the Inner
Tea
City
Room
News there.
I'd have a Dixwell Tea Room over there.
Nice bookstore.
And you have
a
that
bookstore.
Big lot in the back where you have events when the weather's nice, like the barbecues.
Clean
Jackie Jack just wanted to have
that parking lot. Yeah, because, you know, the Elks is right
festival.
There, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, the Elks has its roots there in the Correct. Community. And so all of that history is, like, right there. But
So, but we need the present, too. We need viable businesses. So what you have there is you have the smoke shop, which, you know, the people bringing in the illegal cigarettes from the South and selling them as Lucy's and the police always having problems, right? And you have some of the Asian-owned businesses, which sometimes has been a source of tension of like boutiques. Then you have the big space that had the old Sea Town, which is empty.
That's what I mean. I'd put a theater friends. In there. Like
I would too.
I'd put a theater.
I always thought that was the perfect place for theater.
Not,
you have
not
a park
so much a movie theater, but a playhouse.
Why not a movie theater?
Well, I mean, I guess a movie theater.
Because can't you put on plays at Wexler Grant and the Q House right across?
Yeah.
I'm thinking,
right.
let's
think
of
theater is a good thing because I really and truly like
We're
to
just
see
dreaming.
People. Yeah, okay.
Don't kill my dream.
I'm not going to kill
No, Joe, but are you thinking about the market too? The fact that people are watching more movies online at home and streaming them?
Not only that, I just don't want to start seeing people feeling isolated and start being up in that area only. I want to see them involved, like come downtown to the criteria.
There's nothing to come downtown.
But Joe, you're saying don't develop Dixwell Plaza because you want them coming
because
downtown.
Because you want to force poor
said
black
don't
people.
Develop. I just said do not.
I'd love
I
to have
a
black
theater
alliance right there. Where we could have, because you know what? Because this is a.
But why not do that at the Q House? Why not do
that
at the Q House?
The demographics in that part of Dixwell is changing because of the new Latino wave that has come in. You have Latinos renting the Elks Club. now to have a lot of their parties.
Oh, and there's a Caribbean
restaurant
there now, too.
And you have them opening up a lot of stores around there. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like years ago. You
and
know,
you have
the,
Yale's
the
gentrification, too.
Dixwell Avenue.
And you got to have more students there because Yale's actually buying property.
I'd love to have
and Yale is, like, creeping up Dixwell.
That's right. And then look on Goff, too. They bought Dixwell. The old church on Goff. It's now vacant. Now. They got some plans we don't know for that whole first block of Goff. They now own all the property going back. I forget the name. The one that had been there like 100 years.
St. Martin de Porres?
No. I'm talking on Goff, across from Agape, a little closer downtown.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
That's all closed now. It's all closed now.
Yeah,
they went to State Street.
That.
Yeah, Rex is, goes, you know, from Seaclix, she goes there. They closed that place. So it's just they're just mothballing it. They took down the UPS store.
Right.
So
yeah,
they're doing
mm-hmm.
They're doing some kind of back storage stuff midway in the block. So something's up for that whole block. Meanwhile, on Dixwell, they've bought more property. So they opened up that kind of juice store, which is not a yuppie store. I see who goes in there. And I see who goes in there and what they're selling. It's people who work at Local 35 and live in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's just nice. You think that's going to change?
Of course.
But you know, the
but there will be more students. There's no doubt. So anything that happens at Dixwell Plaza, you theoretically could have students involved. It's not that invisible barrier you used to have.
But look at the demographics in New Haven, how it's changing. The African American community is moving more to Hamden than That's New right. Haven. We have less African Americans now here in New Haven than we did before because they're all moving into West Haven and they're moving into Hamden.
That's true numerically, Norma, but isn't it still true that the African Americans who are here, they're all over town, but if you look at like West Hills, New Hallville, and Dixwell, isn't that still the largest concentration? Isn't it still defined even numerically as African-American neighborhoods, even though they are somewhat mixed?
It is, but a lot of Latinos are moving into those areas. I'm really surprised.
Keep going the
because before, you know, people would move based ethnicity-wise.
Correct.
Now with the new immigrants have really changed the face of New Haven because they don't care. They don't ask about the neighborhood. If they find a rent, that's where they move to. And that has really drastically changed.
But wherever they're living, they can listen to Pundit Friday on Dateline New Haven on WNHH New Haven's home for community radio, broadcast at 103.5 FM and live streamed at newhaven.org. It's Pundit Friday. And Norma, you do always bring up the stuff we didn't think of. You always got that Latino angle. But with Babs Rawls Ivy, Marquisa Ricks, Norma Rodriguez Reyes, and the man of many positive epithets, Joe Ugly, in the studio breaking down the news. So Babs Rawls Ivy hosted a very interesting event in town this week. You know, every month, the Deltas, this sorority, is holding a community conversation about where we go next after the Trump election, just informing people what the issues are and trying to tease out some big issues. And Babs, from what I tell from the reports, including in New Haven Independent by Tom Breen,
which is really good. And I thought Tom captured the excitement of the evening because it really was exciting.
You posed a question that had such historic echoes that go back to the arguments maybe between Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, but definitely between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King or Stokely Carmichael Martin Luther King. And you said, what is the black agenda? We had a black agenda civil rights movement centered on equal rights. A black agenda in the late 60s was black power. What is the black agenda in 2017? And she got a difference of opinion. It was respectful. It was a kind conversation, but passionate. And you had the Urban League, Valerie Schultz Wilson, said, why do we need a black agenda? Our agenda is an American agenda. We want jobs. We want education. We want housing. We want criminal justice reform. Why do we need to label it? We cannot allow people to say that's a black agenda, so we don't have to worry about it. These are things every American should want. And then Kamel Scott Mujahid from Connecticut Core said, when you look historically at how change has happened in this country, whenever we have ignored race, the solutions that have been proposed and have been accepted have always passed our community by. We need to insist on being seen because to not have our own agenda is accept invisibility. That was a really interesting question.
It was powerful.
And as an outsider of this debate who has followed it in its many forms, like the Stokely Carmichael Martin Luther conversation, when he said, when you really have the power, you don't say it. Like they don't say white power except for white people who don't have power and want it. The people in the banks who do what they do or the real estate companies or government, they never say it's white power, even though it kind of is. And other people like Martin Luther King were saying the only way you're going to succeed as a diverse country to get justice that everyone include broad-based programs that look at poverty that disproportionately help the African-American community, but are for everybody like Social Security. But then other people say, in fact, there's such deep racism, not only the bill for past racism, lost opportunity, but that we have to feel proud of who we are as black people and asserting the ways we are specifically held back because of our race, that we have to, a lot of people found that power message was so powerful to people in terms, in a positive way, of asserting what they can accomplish and not be second-class citizens. So as an outsider, I always thought the answer was yes, meaning they're both right, even though they sound like opposite ideas. But I've talked too much. I'm wondering what you guys thought if
you're in
that conversation.
I think you're absolutely right. I think yes on both sides. I think, you know, you have to understand the history of America. You know, there were laws that were created to keep black folks at a disadvantage, like deliberate. It wasn't made up.
Or just towns burned down like Tulsa, the black part of town.
And not just Tulsa, but there were several towns that well-to-do black folks did well, and white folks just didn't like it and burnt them to the ground. And people still remember this. Like, there are people still alive that remember these things. So, you know, from the Constitution itself.
Well, right now you got the mortgages, where if you're black and you're employed, you have less of a chance of getting a mortgage than a white person who's unemployed.
Or anything.
And you're, I think it's about
or
one
being
tenth,
turned away from particular neighborhoods.
And your asset wealth that you could pass on or use as a cushion if you lose a job is just out of whack.
So there are things that were deliberately done that built the foundation for what we consider racism now.
So the question becomes, how do you move forward? And your people you were speaking to when you posed that great question, some people say we're going to succeed better by not calling it a black agenda or even thinking about a black agenda, but part of a broader based agenda. And other people say we have to assert it out front as black, who we are as black.
Well, what I find quite interesting when people say we don't need a black agenda, it's always directed at black people. Like, we are the only people that can't say this is what we want to do. This is how we want to move forward. Everybody else gets to have an agenda. But the minute we say an agenda, then it becomes we're not being good citizens. We're not being Americans.
American. Or you're defined as a special interest the way that other groups are not defined as a special
exactly.
interest.
Exactly. Like, no one, you know, women
CEOs
can have
are
a
not
women's
a special
agenda
interest.
And no one bats an eye. And it's kind of expected to have a women's agenda. But if I say a black woman's agenda or black people's agenda or black children's agenda, then everything becomes suspect.
So it sounds like you were more with Camille on this question.
I'm on both sides, right? Because I understand Mrs. Schultz's position, because she comes from a place where I don't want to be other. Like, don't just see me as other. See me as who I am, but not
I also
other.
Thought there was a tactical question. I thought Camille was saying tactically we lose if we subsume our own identity and needs and demands. And the other side says tactically we win if we're out front that we are black, we're part of this coalition, we have issues we're pushing, but that part of a broader base is going to help everyone find that common ground so the Obama approach is
I think it's
together.
Sort of like code switching. It's something that black people do to exist in spaces where we might need to be one way with people who don't look like us and one way with each other. So while we're out here strategizing for a black agenda, we might not bill it as a black agenda to other people, but it's code switching.
That you're absolutely right.
To be successful, you have to be able to do both.
And this is the problem with young people that we see in our communities, because they don't understand how to do that yet. They haven't been trained up to understand how to switch. But those of us that, you know, have grown up and done some stuff, we know how to switch. We know how to curtail the language. Like how I speak now, when I'm with my squad, that's a whole different kind of conversation, right?
For real.
For real. For real. For real, though.
The way we talk at lunch is not the way we talk at Pundit.
For shizzle.
But, you know, I think this was generational. Because the issue here is that our children, okay, back then, we had to fight for a space and to be treated a certain way. But now with this generation, and also our generation, we were supposed to marry our own, even religious and culturally. Now with this generation intermingling, they have absolutely no tolerance for that stuff. They really don't.
Oh, no,
have African Americans that will get really pissed off at you if you talk about a Latino, and Latinos that will get pissed off at you if you talk about African Americans, because they grew up together and they feel that they're family.
I think that's geographical. In this area, yes. And I say, you know, I hold that right. But when you go to the Midwest, you do see different levels of
a kind of hardening of
a hardening of race of groups, yeah. Correctly. You know, you see a level of segregation. But, and that's the one thing that I always check myself on here. when I'm giving a social opinion, I'm always checking to see, is it coming from just where my environment, or is it, you know, when I make the across the board statements or judgments, I'm always saying, okay, is this a reflection of my environment or across the board? Because we see people go to DC and make laws. They make laws to affect certain communities based on their little area. They never travel outside their zones. Crickets?
Listening intently.
But you know something, go ahead.
When you talk about race, is something very that we have to treat very carefully. Because, for instance, in New Haven, we have, okay, maybe it's not a real 100% coalition, but it doesn't exist in Bridgeport and it doesn't exist in Hartford, an African-American Latino relationship.
Norma, I never see it in New Haven. I always see them at odds, whether it was the recent argument with the police chief. I always feel like one community feels politically. I'm not talking about the everyday people. And I think maybe that's what you're talking about. When I'm talking about the people who are involved in politics or activism, I'm not
everybody's
seeing
scrapping
a lot of that.
For their
I guess I saw some of it in the Pro Casanova demonstration that was organized. But in general, I often have, as a reporter, I've always heard one group thinking the other group's got the in with the people in power, which isn't always true. And
but
jealous about who's getting
what.
But
bad here in New Haven, it's worse, okay, in Bridgeport and in Hartford. And see, I came here very young.
I guess we do have the Black Hispanic Caucus, which is now a majority of the Board of Alders, and they do a great
and
job
I think
together.
They get
they're
along.
Completely,
they're learning
completely.
How to, that it benefits.
I thought it was, when I sat
ways.
On the Board of Aldermen, I thought the Black and Hispanic Caucus was strong too. I mean, that was like a decade ago, right?
So I guess that's one counter argument to what I was saying.
I could think back to the 80s going to the Black and Hispanic Caucus as well, going to all their meetings and events. Seemed very much so together.
But they didn't always stay together when it came to election time.
True.
When you looked at like the seminal election 1989 for mayor, first Black mayor, John Daniels, mm-hmm. the Latino politicians, mm-hmm. political people were all on the side of John Stefano, the white candidate, although I think it was 60% of the Latino vote on the ground went to the Black candidate, John Daniels. And that was kind of interesting to me. And then 4 years later, we probably could have had Mayor Tomas Reyes. And then the key Black decision maker behind the scenes of where the resources were going to go, Wendell Harp, decided he'd rather have a Black candidate who had no chance of winning, who spoke to Black interests, than support a Latino politician who really could have won and governed, with whom he was on very good personal terms and it worked often, but didn't support him. I mean, is that the way you remember it?
No, you're right.
See, to me, I remember the relationship started with the Latino, the perceived relationship was with Walter Brooks, Tommy Reyes, Geraldo Canto, and
Jim Newton?
Rick Turner.
Okay, so you're talking those are two Black and
those
two Latino politicians in the Hill.
And mm-hmm. in the Hill.
1980s.
See, in the Hill, we needed to relate to develop a coalition in order for the African Americans or the Latinos to win. Whereas it wasn't so in Dixwell and it wasn't so in East Shore. So I always used to comment that there really wasn't any difference between the Blacks in Dixwell and the whites from East Shore. Because since they had the numbers and they control, they didn't
today, maybe what you're saying about it, you believe from your observation, we have to look at the data to see if it's true, that racial compositions of neighborhoods is changing. And that, in fact, in Dixwell, you think might be diverse. Maybe that'll be a good sign for if there are more of a mix of people living in near, there's more possibilities for political coalitions.
Yep.
Well, there's always a chance to remind people that are listening to Pundit Friday, WNHH on Dateline New Haven. We're in New Haven's home for community radio broadcast at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. And it's Pundit Friday with Babs Rawls Ivy, Markeisha Ricks, Norma Rodriguez Reyes, and Mr. Joe Ugly in the studio breaking down the week's news. Well, actually, Markeisha Ricks was at the studio, and she was at the Hartford, at the Capitol, the state Capitol this week in the legislature. The session began. It's going to be a big state legislative session for New Haven. About half our budget, roughly, comes from the state. There's a $1.5 billion deficit. There's going to be a lot of cuts coming down the pike. A lot of people are wanting to see what can we save, what can we preserve, what are we going to have to fight for. And, you know, it was one thing Markeisha told me. There was a joint session of the legislature to hear an opening message from the governor. And one thing Markeisha told me was kind of interesting was that we talked here about code switching and everything. People were very clear where they stood on one issue. When the governor made a pro sanctuary state, immigrants' rights statement. According to Markeisha, what happened again? One side of the room stood and one sat down?
Yeah, so the legislature, the way they sit apparently is divided by party. So the Democrats sit on one side, the Republicans sit on the other. And so when the governor made that statement, all the Democrats, including those Democrats in the Senate, stood up and clapped. And all the Republicans sat.
What was the statement?
The statement was something along the lines of, if whether you've been here 300 years or 3 days, you're welcome. And that drew a standing ovation.
So according to Republicans, but from one side from the room.
I'm sorry?
That's standing ovation from one side.
The standing ovation came from one side of the room.
What was the other side doing?
Sitting.
Not a single Republican stood up?
Not that I could tell, unless somebody behind me was standing up. But I made a point to look, because I noticed out of my peripheral vision on my left-hand side, because I had my back, I was kind of standing in the center because I needed to be able to get good pictures of the governor. I noticed that the left-hand side stood up. And I wasn't sure at first. I was like, this looks like all Democrats to me. So I had to go find out whether, and I asked one of our representatives, Robin Porter. I was like, because she brought it up. And I was like, do you all sit on one side? And she's like, yeah, we all do sit on one side.
You know, since the Republican Party historically has been as pro-immigrant as Democrats, because Democrats had a base that was sort of white, working class, and more resentful of immigrants. And the Republicans represented big employers who benefited from the cheaper labor. And now, and also there was an old civil rights tradition in the Republican Party until the 1970s that went all the way back to the Civil Liberties Union. And now it's so interesting to me that that party, you wouldn't have a single person standing up. Because, you know, obviously the subtext.
And I believe the person I was actually standing next to, he appeared to be maybe of Indian descent. And he didn't stand up either.
So that's just like, you better get in line. It's a little peer pressure. But I mean, the subtext,
but I
obviously.
Think he might be one of those very like Republican pro, like if you're going to be an immigrant, you must come in this way. You must meet all the requirements. You must be vetted. And, you know, there are Republicans are like, I, you know, and maybe even some Democrats who are like, I believe in immigration, but it has to be legal. It has to be this way. It has to.
So the subtext is that Governor Malloy, a Democrat governor, is taking a national stand on behalf of protecting immigrants, even those here who are undocumented. He has said we are going to remain a sanctuary state, even if the Trump administration says that we're going to defund states. And I'll obviously have a fight with Utah, too, which is a red state and calls itself a sanctuary state. And I think that's part of what's brewing beneath the surface about how much are we going to stand up to a new administration that won its office partly on bashing immigrants, saying we're going to go after people here. We're going to resume these raids. We're going to throw them out of the country. And what's your sense, Norma, when you're hearing all that? What do you think the mood is right now? Let's say you in the caucus, how big an issue is this for Latino elected officials?
You know how they've been talking about bad news, fake news in the internet. And there was a picture of our first lady, Michelle Obama, with a sign saying, "I lost my job to an immigrant."
The first lady, right, who is an immigrant. That's pretty funny.
And I said, do you believe Michelle would carry a sign like that? Please, you know?
But then on the other hand, when you talk about the two parties, there was a subtext to the first day of the session that I thought really spoke well of the ability of Republicans and Democrats to get along in Connecticut, where it's like, you look what's happening in North Carolina. The Republicans changed the rule because this Democrat governor to get rid of his power and fight like that so they can't govern. In Connecticut, we have a tied chamber, the state Senate, 18 Republicans, 18 Democrats. The ties are going to be broke by a Democrat lieutenant governor. Not only do the leaders of Republicans and Democrats work out a power share agreement with no fights, no drama, really good solutions, having joint state Senate and House committees that have more co-chairs from both parties so that no one is running the show. And two leaders, Martin Looney and Len Fasano, the Democratic and Republican leaders respectively, who worked out this agreement and in the past have worked on bipartisan health care reform legislation, even when they disagree on other issues. That to me was stunning. And also because Martin Looney's got a kidney transplant. He's the state Senate president. He's from New Haven. He's a Democrat. His doctor said, you're not ready to go back. He went back. On his hospital bed, he worked out this agreement with the Republican leader, Len Fasano. And I just think that, you know, while the headline, Chris Murphy talked about this to the senator when he's in here on NHA 3 weeks ago. He's, yes, there's a lot of bad news about government dysfunction, bipartisanship. But there's also good news that sometimes it does work. And in Connecticut, I think I have optimism for this session. The Republicans now cannot just be the backbenchers taking the easy shots at the Democrats. They're going to have to be part of solutions. They won their seat at the table. And I think with that kind of leadership that gets along and respect each other and depersonalizes tensions.
So we'll see when stuff hits the tables.
I would say there might be a little tension down in the House, mm-hmm. though. And The reason being, so there's a new Speaker of the House. I would butcher his last name.
Yeah, me too. Joe A. Who works for a union.
Exactly, because it starts with an A and ends with a Z, that last name. And I thought what was interesting, so when they're nominating the Speaker of the House, everybody already knows who's nominated, that sort of thing, and who it's essentially going to be and who they've agreed upon. But the majority leader, I believe, is Representative Matt Ritter, gives this impassioned speech about how great a guy Joe is. And conversely, the minority leader, Themis Claridis, gets up to give a speech as well. It's a speech in support, but also takes kind of digs at Joe because I believe the Republicans think that he has a conflict of interest.
Right, because he works,
for a union. Yeah. So she makes it several points in her speech to say, you know, basically, I hope you'll govern fairly. I hope you'll do what's best, you know, because we have some concerns, but I hope you'll do what's best for
but
the
But that is such a far cry from what you see in North Carolina,
oh,
what you see in the National,
absolutely.
What you see in U.S.
But
Congress.
The partisan is the ability to be partisan is very much there, particularly in the House. And they're, you know, the Republicans are kind of crowing a little bit. They're like, we're moving that needle over. This side of the room is getting bigger.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with
your
partisan.
Side of the room is getting smaller.
Like, we do want the parties to stand for different stuff. Like, the Themis Claridis and Lymphosana were pretty harsh in their words, not harsh personally, about how the state wasn't dealing with its pension problems. And now we have a new deal to work with pensions that still is leaving us in our, they announced yesterday, the weakest position our state pension system has been in over 30 years with under 40% funding. They said, this is what we're talking about. Now we're going to debar a solution. I think Democrats and Republicans should be partisan and stand strongly for what they believe in. The question is, when do they become dysfunctional and unable to work together toward a common good and to compromise and to let fake posturing get in the way of governing?
See, well, we have a whole Congress who's done that. And I think it's great that our state legislature, our General Assembly hasn't done that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
And also, a lot of the fights are with the Democrats.
But I like a good fight, though. I like a good political fight
on
because
the
out of that,
people
on
have
the
to work together.
Not crap. Like, I don't like crap fights, but real good fights where out of the ashes, good stuff comes out, comes up, right? And not foolishness, but good.
The biggest
fighting.
Fights are also within one party, often, like right now within the Republican Party nationally, if you're looking at how to deal with Russia. But even in the state,
I don't understand this.
If you
whole
look at Tony
thing,
Walker, the state rep from New Haven, talked about when he heard the big news was Dan Malloy said, when we're going to make these huge cuts in the budget, we're going to protect cities' education funding. A real switch from him, a real switch for the legislature, I think, is a result of that judge's ruling in the lawsuit for education equity late last year. And Tony Walker, the state rep from New Haven, powerful position, runs the Appropriations Committee, said, I'll believe it when I see it. I've learned with Dan Malloy.
To wait.
You can't take his word.
Yeah, you got to wait to see what
really
he does.
She really was very upset with him last session on cuts to social services, and she feels that it's her own party's person who can't be trusted. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is that what you picked up on, Markeisha?
Yes.
<what? laughs>
That's essentially what I felt like she was saying.
Okay. You're listening to Pundit Friday on WNHH. Another big issue is going to be needle exchange. You know, eras change.
I saw that. It's going away.
Well, it's not going away. It's not existing today. Right now, there's no needle exchange in New Haven as of today. In 1990, New Haven pioneered the needle exchange. That's when you give free needles
that.
To addicts
and
in return
people were
for
them fighting
getting dirty
about that.
Ones. And at first, people thought you can't do that, including Democrats and New Haven street people, AIDS activists did it first. And then the city started its own program that gave... They said the idea is if you get the dirty needles off the street, you stop the spread of AIDS and other infectious diseases because that's often how it's transmitted. And New Haven's program got research from the Yale School of Medicine that proved it was saving lives. And then New York City's Mayor David Dinkins used that as the basis for saying, you see, it works. So even though we were culturally against this, we're going to do it now. It's done all over the country. At this point, New Haven was the last city in the state to have its own program. We were the first and then the last. Hartford and Bridgeport had it, and then they gave it up. And they turned it over to private groups that had similar programs. And they want to do that in New Haven, too. Yale Medical School has a van that goes around and gives health care in neighborhoods already. Because the New Haven program had a van that went to neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. They already give some clean needles, not as part of an exchange. So they could take it up. But it wasn't as seamless as it was being announced because they haven't yet reached a deal with Yale. The state said you could transfer our money for the program. The state's going to be changing its rules anyway, saying we want you to find ways to consolidate services so we're not paying for a separate government van to do the same thing a private Yale van is doing. But there were other stuff going on at the needle exchange. There was a lot of dissension on the staff. There was two CHRO, that's health human resources complaints, civil rights complaints by staffers. One woman said, I'm gay. I was getting picked on for that. But there were obviously tensions within the department, how it was run. They weren't giving out as many needles because they were down on the staffing. And So I'm hoping that that needle exchange will be up and running as soon as possible. I think it might be the right idea to switch it, but I think it was kind of a messy handoff.
I mean, you're probably right. I mean, you know, I mean, sometimes change is necessary.
Now, is it necessary, do you think, for a black college to be marching in an inaugural parade with their band for the President of the United States?
I think it's shameful.
What happened to your bipartisan spirit 7 minutes ago? Okay. 7 minutes ago.
That was a different issue.
Talladega College, right? Their marching band, the Marching Tornadoes, will be marching later this month in the 58th presidential inauguration. And a lot of other bands didn't want to participate. But the president, Billy Hawkins, said that we're all Americans, back to Babs Forum. And he says, we respect and appreciate how some of our alumni feel. But as many of those who chose to participate in the parade have said, we feel the inauguration of a new president is not a political event, but a civil ceremony. Celebrating
really
the transfer
and the civil ceremony is in regards to what a political
running the government,
and that's not a political thing.
What about when Obama was inaugurated? Do you think it was people should have boycotted that?
No, absolutely not. And here's the difference. The difference that I
is that we liked Obama, we didn't like Trump.
Well, that's
this
too.
Is not about this. Not
no,
a like.
No.
It's not a like.
I'm not afraid to say it. Yes.
He's poking you guys a little bit.
No, he's still my president. And by the way, that's something that I hold dearly, and I never say one is not my president. If he's elected, he's my president. But this guy, I'm really on the border about this.
Actually, Obama's the only person I ever felt was my president, just to be honest.
Well, okay, that's it. And you're entitled to that. But the way I always look at it as, you know, there's one who hold that office. I've always seen that individual as my president, going back to as far as Ford, Carter, Reagan, all the way through. I've always respected that position, and especially serving in the military and then being a veteran. This guy I question strongly because his actions is pure treason. It's, when you look, and you look at treason, and I knew what we were held accountable for treason, is being able, is aiding and comforting foreign government.
So for you, it's not about running office as a racist and unleashing hate crimes and mobs. For you, it's about Russia.
That's one of it.
And that's why you would not have a marching band go to his parade?
I'm saying that's one of my objections to him. Okay. But as far as going to the marching band situation, I think that how do we tell our kids to stand up for our, you know, for right when we're going to have a historically black college at that, you know, something that's supposed to stand for the race. All this is their explanation. Their only explanation is they want free commercials.
No. He said here our explanation is that we respect the peaceful transfer of power. It's all of our country and we participate in it.
Paul, the peaceful transfer of power, if you look at it, it was brought up to me that just as Barack Obama is respecting the peaceful transfer of power, Barack Obama has a responsibility to the United States of America and all the citizens across the board to make sure that we're all feeling comfortable. The historically black college should take a stand to represent the people, the black of America.
So you think black people should not participate in the inauguration? What do you guys think? Any other views?
It sounds like they're representing that 14% of black people who voted for Trump.
That's a good point, Joe. 14% voted for
Trump.
No,
black in color and black in
slave catchers was black folks too.
Exactly. It's true. And I think actually, while I don't support them, I know a number of Talladega alumni who don't support the marching band participating. It goes down the line to that classic historical debate among black folks about what we do and what we don't do, right? It's couched in black respectability politics and whether we just, you know, we're Americans, so we need to do what Americans do and support our new president, in quotes, he ain't my president.
How about you, Babs?
He's not my president. So
would you let them march?
And no, I wouldn't let them march. I would say no.
How about Norma, if they called you up and said, let your group come march, would you
march? I'd march in a heartbeat.
How come?
The National Association of Hispanic Publication, you know, they sent us all of the newspapers across the nation. The Hispanic,
you have to get closer.
All of the Hispanic newspapers across the nation, we were sent invitations because they were all going to be there. Also, a lot of the actors, the Hispanic actors, some of them refused. And yet others, they had a long line. If you refuse, then there's a whole bunch that are willing to be
there.
So
you're going to go to the inauguration?
Not because. I would have loved to have gone to the inauguration, but that just wasn't important to me at this time. I mean, when Clinton won, I was there, you know. Unfortunately, I couldn't make it to Obama's. But my whole thing is that
he might have time to have coffee with you now that after 19.
That it's an honor to go to these events because it's not the person for me.
Really?
It's the position that I've learned to respect.
I don't have any respect.
I've learned to respect
it.
That position, but however, what this person holding the position stands for is very dangerous.
Now, there are alternatives. There are alternatives. There's a Million Woman March.
That's yep. right.
That's taking place. I think my daughter's
there
saw that one.
There is a peace
one.
Ball yes. as
Where's
well.
That?
It's going to be in Washington, D.C.
And the peace ball is an annual thing.
And by the way, in Connecticut.
That is actually nonpartisan.
Wait a minute. Are you kidding me? I just bought my wig. I was going to the women's march. What's wrong with you?
You can go to the peace ball instead.
Well, do you know there is
take off the band
another
first.
Time.
In Connecticut, there is an inaugural ball taking place that night, that Friday night. I can't go because it's Friday night. And it's being run by Colin McRae of NPR and Bill Curry, the former state comptroller, A.D. Clinton. And what it is, they're going to have a ball in Hartford Real Arts Ways. It's $15 to come. They're going to have a New Orleans marching band doing a death march, a funeral march. They're going to have
I'd go for that.
They're going to have grief counselors on hand. They're going to have some dancing too.
Just have some champagne and scotch.
So that is an alternative. But you know, I think the last word should really come from the commenter 3/5 of the New Haven Independent commenting section. I love his comments, and I love the way it gets everybody upset. And he was commenting because they were trying to decide. New Haven has an environmental advisory committee that was writing letters. They argued for an hour about how to write a letter to Obama and Trump about the session ending and the administration coming in, about how to deal with the environment. And they're writing letters to them about what they're hoping will happen. And 3/5 said, I'll write the letter for you. And he wrote it like this instead. Dear American lost sheep votes, I wish you would stop voting for the crooked two-party system. The Republicans and Democrats are actually one party. They are the business party. It is clear that neither party has the best interests of America at heart, and it is time for change and to end the two-party system. It is time to go with the individual instead of a party platform that does little to address the pressing needs of America. And we can get there if we take the Democratic donkey and the Republican elephant, put them on a raft, and push both out to sea and fight for the system of proportional representation, which would give the true voice to the people. Can I get an amen?
No.
Can I get a... He's crazy?
Viking, so they're
throwing
the fire.
Everybody can say what they want to say. I mean, he's entitled to opinions.
And 3/5 like, says, you know what? But I love what you guys say every Friday on Pundit Friday and WNHH Radio. Thank you so much for joining. It is a highlight of my week every week to be in the studio with these wonderful, wonderful people and just try to run down what's happening in our community. Thanks for joining us on Dateline New Haven for another year getting going just right. Oh, thanks my. To pundits Babs Rolls or Ivy. Robs Rolls Ivy, Marquisha Ricks, Norma Rodriguez Reyes, and Joe Ugly, whose names include words that begin with Q and Z, even though
I
cheated
a
little
impressed.
Because one of those words actually has an X but a Z sound.
I thought I was thinking that when I heard her.
Zella like, Zapper of Xenophobia.
Okay, you got to build in one day.
We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book it and fly free with us all day and all night, all weekend long at WNHH New Haven's home for community radio. Good Shabbos, everybody.